So this is Karen Phelps, and I want to welcome all of you to this call, and I want to thank you for joining us tonight as I interview someone that I admire very much, and that's Richard Brook. And Richard is he's the author of Mach 2 with Your Hair on Fire, and I'm not sure if you haven't read this book, trust me, by the end of this call, you will be, you know, like the first one to his website, just, you know, ready to get this book. But he's the president of OxyFresh, and he's founder of High Performance People. He's been leading, coaching, and training leaders from high school sophomores to multimillionaire business leaders for over 20 years. Through Richard's influence, hundreds of new leaders have discovered new distinctions in listening, leadership, courage, relationships, public speaking, team spirit, and big time fun. And, you know, that's one of the things when I was looking at your book here, I'm like, okay, this guy really likes to have fun. I'm looking at your solid mahogany boat and your helicopter, and I think, wow, you know, that's a lot of fun. So, well, Richard, welcome to the call. I'm really, really glad you could join us here tonight.
Thank you, Karen. I've been an admirer and a follower of your for years. You do magnificent work in our industry, and I was delighted and surprised to hear from you. I'm not sure where you got my book, but I was when you said you had an enormous database and you told me the size of it and you wanted to do a call. That's exciting.
You just figured, yeah, might as well.
This would be fun.
Yeah, it is fun. So I want to let everybody know right now, you can write these websites down because some of you are followers of Richard. Some of you are followers of me. I want to make sure that you know both of our websites because both of us have great newsletters that you can sign up for, electronic newsletters that are free. Richard's website is www.richardbrook, that's BROOKE, there's an E on the end of it, Richard Brook with an E on the end, .com. So if you're new to Richard, haven't followed him yet, then you want to get on his website and sign up for his free newsletters. And if you're new to me, if you're following Richard and don't have a clue who I am, you might want to check me out at www.karenphelps, that's K-A-R-E-N, PHELPS.com, and sign up for the free newsletters on both of our sites. Tonight I'm going to be talking to Richard about his book Mach 2 with Your Hair on Fire, and I know you are absolutely going to love what he has to say, but I know that some of you are going to want to know more, so we're going to be letting you know how you can get some more later on, where to go to so that you can get some more. And I got to tell you, Richard, I think I might have gotten this as maybe at a DSA event I went to. I think it was like a sales and marketing DSA event that I got it. Does that sound like it might have been something that happened?
I don't know.
You don't know. So people are just giving your books out. I know I received it as a gift, and it was really nice. And I was reading it actually on the way home from my leadership boot camp that we just did in Las Vegas in October. And we did a two-day leadership boot camp. And then the following day, the bonus day on Sunday, was called that I did a bonus day called Blueprint for Success and Prosperity. Monday on the way home, for some reason, I had grabbed your book and thrown it in my suitcase because I always have books when I travel, always, always. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure you have books too. And I grabbed this book and I started reading it on the way home. And literally from Vegas to Michigan, I never put it down. I never fell asleep. My husband's sleeping, snoring, and everything. And I finished all but maybe the last 10 pages in the book, and I finished those when I got home. It was such a good read, I just could not put it down. So for those that don't know you, Richard, I was really, really fascinated with your story of your early beginnings. So can you share a little bit about, with our listeners, a little bit about where you came from so they understand that, you know, you weren't born with that silver spoon in your mouth. You were just real people, just like every single person on this phone call tonight.
Happy to, and it reminds me of this past weekend. I was in Las Vegas with Michael Klaus and Les Brown, and I was interviewing Michael Klaus and Les Brown, and it was kind of interesting because here's the three of us on stage, and I'm the only one with a high school education, and none of us have a college education. And So that is part of my beginnings. I was raised by an educated family. My dad was a graduate of Stanford. My mom was a graduate of Mills College, which is kind of a private women's college in Oakland that was an equivalent of Stanford. And all of my family was very well educated, except for me. And that's not because I didn't have the opportunity. I just wasn't interested. I did very little work in school, and I guess mostly played. I must have a core value of playing, because that started early and continued all the way through school and business. You know, but I also, my parents did not come from an entrepreneurial background. So when I graduated from high school, which was barely, you know, I didn't have any coaching or guidance or understanding about how to go into business, or I just took the first job that somebody offered. You know, somebody asked me one time, why'd you take that job at the chicken plant? And the answer was really simple. They were hiring. That's why I took it. There wasn't anything else to do. It didn't seem. I worked at a gas station before that. Besides not having an education and working at a chicken plant, my personality was, I think, the most significant thing that I like to pay attention to relative to the change that this kind of work has provided me. I was a very introverted, angry, self-centered, didn't like people at all. The last career I would ever think about doing was sales, and recruiting is even worse than sales, and public speaking is the, you know, you might as well die. But fortunately, personal development for me came wrapped in the present of network marketing or financial opportunity. And that did get my attention. I was interested in having money, having more money than I had. I worked at this chicken plant. I started making $3.05 an hour. This was in 1974. And you know, just to give you an example of my personality, I actually worked my way up in the chicken plant pretty well the first couple of years. They started giving me the opportunity to teach other people how to cut chickens. But one day, you know, my boss did something that I didn't like. And I don't know how to tell this story without using this word, and I apologize ahead of time. But I told my boss to go to hell in front of his boss. And you can imagine what that did for my chicken plant career. But that just gives you an insight into my personality. You know, I think anybody on the planet knows in corporate America and business, you just don't do that. But I got introduced to network marketing, which I was interested in the money, but what caused my success was personal development. I was very fortunate to be introduced to network marketing through a company that was all about personal development. They had a product, but the product was really the people, and they understood that most of us really wanted to be successful, but we didn't have the tools to become successful. We didn't have the distinctions, we didn't have the beliefs, we didn't have the skills. And so they spent most of their time teaching us, most of their time, you know, feeding us books and tapes, and all of the seminars were not about the product and about the compensation plan. Or the seminars that we went to were all about personal development. And but,
yeah,
first,
that's what it's all about.
Years, it is. I mean, that's I think you and I know, probably everybody on this call believes this, that we earn in accordance to what we're worth to other people. And you and I are not worth a lot to other people unless we're an inspiration to them, a contribution to them, unless we're a peaceful part of their life, a powerful part of their life, somebody that supports them in doing better in life. And you and I can't do that if we're focused on our petty insecurities or our neuroses, our fears, our inadequacies. We can only be a contribution to other people when we're past that, and we bring some spiritual power to other people. And I was very fortunate to get on that path, and it didn't happen overnight. It took, you know, before it even showed up at all, took 3 years of dedicated personal development.
You know what's really funny? You said something that I was laughing because you said you were an introvert. And I was laughing at that because, you know, I tell people that I'm a recovering, what do I tell them? I'm a recovering, actually, that's what I say. I'm a recovering introvert. And, you know, I mean, people just like, yeah, right, you know. But it's kind of funny because I look at you and I look at myself and a lot of successful people. And the reason we overcame that is because of our study of, you know, just improvement, just how to improve, all this self-motivation and everything that you're going to be talking about tonight. That's what changed people. So let's go to the next question, and that is, because change, I believe, is one of the most important factors to anyone's success, and yet so many people are just resistant to change. They can't stand it. You know, I'm always saying the only person that likes change is a wet baby. Why do people resist change?
Well, there's, you know, you and I could talk about that for 3 days. But
well, we only have an hour.
The short answer is not changing is comfortable, and people prefer comfort over discomfort. And then the psychological or motivational reason why people resist change is the payoff for not changing. Is comfort. And if there isn't a payoff that you and I value greater than the perceived comfort, then there's no reason to change. So, for example, if people on the call here, if public speaking is a real issue for you, and you know you just you don't want to get up there, it scares you, you don't like it, and so you don't want to change, you don't want to go through the Toastmasters or the Dale Carnegie program or the whatever program you need to go through to exercise that very weak muscle and get up and actually speak. But if I said, you know, if you'll start speaking at your local meetings, you know, I'll pay you an extra $5,000 a month, and it doesn't matter if you're any good or not, I'll just pay you if you'll get up and talk for 30 minutes every week at your meeting, I'll start paying you $5,000 for every meeting. You know, I think people can get a sense of how easy it is to change if we believe in a motive that's greater than what we're getting for not changing. The challenge people have with changing is, you know, somebody will come to us and say, you know, you need to be different and you need to do this different and, you know, you need to change. But that's really the wrong conversation. The conversation that we need to be having with people is, what do you want in your life that you don't have now? And I'm not talking about money necessarily, but, you know, who do you want to be that you're not now? How do you want to feel that you don't feel now? What do you want to think about that you don't think about now? Who do you want to be for other people that you're not now? Are you afraid now, and would you prefer to be courageous and be at peace? Are you poor now? Do you struggle financially? And would you prefer to have abundance and security? Are you well-respected and liked now or not? And which would you prefer? I think when you talk to people about what they want in their life that they don't now have, and then you take the course of teaching them how to believe that they can get it, to the degree they start to believe that they can get it, change is inevitable. Change is natural. Change is easy. Change is going to happen whether they want it to or not.
And, you know, people with the change, they just get so, people almost need to get to the point where they're just fed up with where they're at right now. Don't you think? And I'm sure that's kind of what happened to you. You just get to the point. In fact, a lot of people, if we look back at some of the major changes we've ever made in our life, we get to a point where it's like we can't stand it anymore and something has to change. So let's talk about what type of changes did you do, or, you know, what kind of changes took place that really helped put you on the path to success. And we know that you got in with network marketing and you were, you know, a lot of the self-improvement. But is there anything else, any other big major changes that you had to, you know, make in order to get you to where you are today?
Well, I think the most important one, Karen, is I did, the chicken plant was not miserable enough for me. I actually liked it there. And I planned on being there the rest of my life. And if these guys hadn't have put so much money in front of me to get my attention, I'd have never looked elsewhere. I was going to run that chicken plant someday. And but what had to happen to get me to change, and the change that I made was after being in full-time in our type of business for 3 years, I was driving a borrowed car because I'd had both of mine repossessed. And I had them repossessed within the first year and a half, and for the next year, I lived on my sister's couch. She was a flight attendant, and I only worked the business when she flew, and I borrowed her car. And then she didn't want me doing that anymore after about a year of living on her couch. So somebody actually loaned me a car, and I was living in a studio apartment, and the only furniture I had was a card table chair, and a bed that folded out of the wall. And I was the type of personality that just had to be at the very bottom, where there was just no option but to climb out before I would embrace the change. And the change that I made that was miraculous and made all the difference in the world is, instead of telling people about personal development, instead of telling people what they should be doing, I started doing it myself. And I had read, in that first 3 years, I had read books and, you know, I'd listened to lots of tapes. I'd done a lot of the superficial stuff. But, you know, just listening to tapes and reading books isn't enough. You have to actually learn what the messages are in those books and tapes and then execute them in your life with diligence and passion and commitment. And I just got to the point where I had no option. You know, I guess I was in that first 3 years, I was trying to figure out, how can I be successful and not really do any of this stuff or change? I mean, I'm willing to listen to the tapes and read the books and talk about it to other people. But, you know, I'll bet there's a lot of people on this call that they read a lot of books, listen to a lot of tapes. But if we went back through and line-itemed the key messages and habits and disciplines and commitments in those books and then went to their life to hold them accountable for how are they actually implementing those ideas, most people wouldn't be.
Right.
I was just giving personal development lip service. And when I actually started doing it myself, really simple things like writing my goals down and studying them, and, you know, reading every day instead of once a week, and, you know, making the core changes to my daily habits and my thought processes. And, you know, the most important one was designing a life that I really wanted and studying that design until I started to believe in it. And I hope we get to talk tonight a little bit about belief, because I think it's a really, really important distinction that people need to have in order to embrace the kind of change that they want. And how we've been taught to believe in this society doesn't really do it, doesn't get the job done.
Well, you know what, that segues right into my next question, because I love what you list as the four greatest lies to success. And I feel, after reading those, that people can become trapped in a life of unfulfillment because these lies are fed to us by well-meaning people who are just stone cold broke and who don't have anything in their life. And, you know, so share with them what the lies are. And then, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about beliefs. So go ahead and share what the lies are and how people can become trapped by those lies.
Okay, well, the first thing I need to say about the lies is usually when I talk about these, or people just read them in the book, they sort of get polarized by them because they interpret from the message that I don't believe any of these things are valuable. And that's not the point that I'm making. Mm-hmm. I think all of these things are very valuable, and everybody should embrace them in their life. I think what's not valuable is to have a belief that if you do these four things, or any of these four things, then you're automatically going to be successful. Like, you know, all right. You have to do is get good grades. And, you know, I don't know what it was about me in school that I just didn't pay any attention to that. I didn't buy into that. I didn't believe it. I just didn't care about it. But most of the people that I went to school with as students, the core belief they had as students was they need to get good grades. And if they get good grades, everything is going to be wonderful. And what you end up with is a bunch of educated people that don't think and can't necessarily perform. It doesn't mean that education is not valuable. It's enormously valuable. But if you think that getting a 4.0 in high school, which will then lead to a great college, and getting a 4.0 in a great college will then lead to a great career, it certainly could be a support, but there's no guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
So the distinction that I'm trying to make is that the number one lie is that education necessarily leads to success. I say it doesn't necessarily lead to success, especially in the form that it is in our educational system, where most of our education is about memorizing answers to tests,
right,
and scoring well on the tests. That has nothing to do with education. But the point is, education is one of those cultural lies in our society. And, you know, parents go crazy over this. Oh, my God, don't lead my kids to not go to college. And you know, I don't want them ending up like Michael Klaus, Les Brown, and Richard Brook, for God's sakes. But it's not that it's not valuable. It's just not an automatic. The other one is hard work. Hard work, I'm certainly not advocating anything other than hard work. But the cultural lie that we have in our society that's sort of programmed in, like our ABCs and any other nursery rhyme, is if I work hard, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to get by. I'm going to be successful. I'm going to stay employed, for example, or I'm going to get what I want in life. And, you know, so I just like to ask people, how many people do you know that have worked really hard their whole lives? They're working hard right now, and they're going backwards.
Mm-hmm.
They're not any closer to having what they really would love to have in their lives than they were when they started 20 or 30 years ago. Maybe your parents are a good example of that. It doesn't mean that hard work isn't valuable, because we also know lots of people that have carved out a great life, and part of the reason is that they worked hard, and part of the reason might be that they did have a good education. The third one is being a fine person, and it doesn't have anything to do with financial success. And, you know, you and I know probably a whole lot of successful people financially that, you know, we just wouldn't want to be like.
Right.
The most important lie that I think was just an enormous breakthrough for me, and is one of the most passionate things that I love to teach people, is that desire doesn't have anything to do with success. And I believed that it did. And I think most people believe that it does. That if you want something bad enough, then you'll be successful. And I am absolutely as clear as I can be in my own heart and my own mind, and anybody that's ever deeply studied these distinctions. Desire doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you and I are successful. Desire might point you and I in a direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want this and I want that. That's really valuable. It could be a spark. But, you know, you and I have lots of things in our lives that we don't want at all. And really, really badly, we'd like for those things to go away. And they tend to hang out. Notice that?
Yeah.
But if desire was important, if desire was led to success, then, you know, how would we have things around us that we didn't want? Desire doesn't have anything to do with it. And there is an enormous distinction between motivation and desire. If you'd asked me 30 years ago, what motivation was, I just said desire, and I'd probably argue to as long as I could about that. But the, one of the huge breakthroughs that I had was discovering that they're not at all the same. They're totally different. Motivation is the key to success, and desire doesn't have anything to do with it at all. And that doesn't mean desire is bad. Certainly not bad. I mean, you're never going to get what you want unless you at least have the original desire for it. My point is, once you it points you in the direction of, I'd like to have that in my life, desire is not that useful.
Right. Richard, in your chapter, which is kind of like your vision, where you talk about reviewing the script of our lives, and that script basically is how we got to where we are right now. And this kind of the whole vision thing, I want you to just talk about it, because you share that there's three forms of vision and each form is going to produce different results. And man, that is, you know, when you read that chapter, it's just like, wow, it just jumps out at you. And I'm sure that the listeners, when they get your book, are going to notice the same thing. It's like, oh, wow. You know, what's funny is that we kind of read books sometimes and you'll be looking at something and you'll think, oh yeah, I know someone like that, or I know someone like that, but we never, you know, sometimes it's harder to find ourselves where we are. But share with our listeners what those three forms of vision are and the results that each vision produces, and a little bit about that script in our lives and how to create, you know, and how to change things around so that we kind of get on the right path.
Okay, well, it really will help the audience if they have my book, or they have a workbook from a seminar, or they just sketch this out on paper. Visually, it helps to understand it. The most important breakthrough that I had in my understanding of this process was to understand that you and I have a vision about everything we can imagine ourselves doing. We already have that vision. So take, for example, your relationship with your primary person in your life, your spouse. You don't perhaps have it written down. It doesn't follow anything that is instructed in my book. But you have a vision already, and you could write it down. And it is in place, and it is motivating you to develop and perform in the relationship in your primary relationship. And it has not necessarily anything to do with how you want that relationship to be. So graphically, if you can imagine this, or you're following along in the graphic that's in the book, if you want, for example, an extraordinary relationship, and you can describe what extraordinary means and looks like, you know, you want love, you want passion, you want listening, you want peace, you want intimacy, you want time together, you want, you know, all these great things. That's what you want. That's one component of this matrix that's very important. And then there is the component of what you have. What you have is, if somebody came into your life and followed you around with hidden cameras and microphones, you and your spouse, and recorded everything you said to each other and how you treated each other and how you looked at each other and how you held each other or didn't, and the, you know, the little things that you said to each other, you know, were they sarcastic and sort of putting off, or were they intimate and embracing and loving? If somebody recorded all of that and then showed it to you, that would be reality.
Right.
That would be your relationship and the feelings that those activities generated. That would be reality. That's the second component of the matrix. The third component is your vision. And your vision, which, you know, it's a little different than the word visionary. Here's some synonyms for vision. A synonym of a vision would be a mindset. Like, if we could peek into your mind and follow your thoughts about how you saw your relationship, how you felt about it, what you said to yourself about it. Intention is a little bit of that, like what your intention is, but it's not the most important part. The most important part is, How do you actually see it? How do you talk about it to yourself? How do you feel about it to yourself? That's your vision. It's a mindset. Another synonym for it might be expectation. Could also be how you believe about your relationship. So if I were to ask you, what are your beliefs about your relationship with your primary person, and you could describe that, that would be your vision. Now, almost nobody in the entire universe has these written down, and almost nobody in the entire university has these visions intentionally or consciously created. The third component of the matrix, the vision component, almost always is created after the fact as a dialogue describing what happened. It's a dialogue describing reality. If it was a dialogue describing what you wanted, then your vision would be more in line with what you wanted. But most people don't spend most of their creative self-talk, imagination, visualization, meditation, rehearsing, debriefing time talking to themselves about what they want. They spend most of that time talking to themselves about what is or what just happened. So take for example, you and your spouse get up in the morning and you know, you start the day off and, you know, something happens, like, oh, you know, she didn't do exactly what you wanted her to do, or he wasn't exactly wonderful or perfect. Where's the dialogue go? Does it go to, you know, things didn't start off great this morning, and let me meditate for an hour on how I envision and want my wonderful relationship to go? Or do we talk about, well, that was kind of lousy, and I wonder why she did that, and, you know, if she's going to do that, well, I'm not doing any more of this, and, you know.
Yeah, all the self-talk becomes negative from then on.
Well, and that is the vision.
Yeah.
So there are three components of this matrix of motivation. One is reality, what is actually happening. One is, what do you want to be happening? And the third is, what do you expect to be happening? For you, in your spiritual, mental, emotional being, how do you hold the relationship? Do you hold it the way it is, which is reality, or do you hold it the way you want it to be, which is expecting, no matter what's going on today, no matter what's gone on in your relationship for the past 3 months, how do you hold it? The way it has been, the way it is, or the way you want it to be? And if you hold it as it is, which most people's vision is generated solely from what's happening, if you want to jump into, for example, people's incomes, their vision about their income is not what they want. Their vision about their income is what they've been earning.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole month they're looking at their, whatever they look at to generate income, all their reports or their distributor office or their sales commissions or their prospects or their, you know, whatever people do in business to look at the business revenue of the month. Most of the conversation that they have and the feelings that they go through throughout the month are made up of what is, not what could be.
Right.
So if the vision is about reality, then the vision is pretty much the same as reality, and that creates a style of motivation I call apathy. Some people might call it laziness. The essence of it is, psychologically, is the vision does not call upon the mind, the spirit, or the body to produce or attract any change to change the reality. So what you and I do when our vision is pretty much aligned with our reality is we're pretty happy, we're pretty complacent. We're the kind of prospect that when people go up to us and say, hey, how'd you like to do this? How'd you like to do that? We're like, eh, you know what? Everything's pretty good here.
Yeah.
And you know, when we actually get a prospect in our business, we might think it's our wonderful recruiting skills and our wonderful tools and our wonderful package, but what it really is, when we get a prospect to respond positively to an opportunity, it's only because we happen to accidentally bump into a prospect who in that moment that we're presenting to them just happen to be accessing a vision of more than they have, which produces motivation. And so we say we have opportunity, and the motivation grabs the opportunity. It is so for about 1 or 2 or 3% of us that we wander around motivated enough to jump on an opportunity. If the vision is less than reality, that's a vision that you could call the style of which is worry or self-sabotage. So let's say the relationship is what it is, or the income is what it is, but most of the time we wander around thinking about, talking about, feeling about how it's probably going to get worse.
Well, and today's economy is feeding all that right now, too.
Yeah, it is if we're watching TV and reading
absolutely.
Newspaper.
You know, I mean, so if everybody around us is negative, what can people do to not get sucked into that downward spiral then?
It's as simple as paying attention to what you use to generate new, fresh thought. There's really only two sources of thought. There is us thinking to ourselves. So if you locked yourself in a room and had no outside input whatsoever, what you would be saying to yourself is information that you already have about the world and about yourself. If you let yourself outside the room, or you let communication into the room, turn on the television set, for example. Let's say you watch TV for an hour. That's like a whole bunch of smartly dressed, very powerful, very credible people standing in the room with all the lights going, talking to you about life, about the world, and about business. And the simple question is, at the end of that, do you feel better about yourself? Do you feel better about your future? Do you have fresh new thoughts of optimism after watching an hour of television? The answer is pretty simple. Probably not, unless you're watching a very unique channel. So maybe you pick up the newspaper. What do you get from reading the newspaper? Or the worst source of all of this is you go out in the world and you talk to other people. Might be your family, might be your friends, might be people at work. After you're done talking to those people or listening to people, simple question, do you feel better about yourself? Are you more inspired about your future? Are you more motivated? Do you have more self-esteem, more self-confidence? Are you more at peace? Or are you irritated? Are you angry? Are you frustrated? Are you worn out from having the life sucked out of you by somebody that needs all of your energy because they burned all of theirs?
Mm-hmm.
Which is it? So it's a real simple process. How do you stay out of the spiral? Be very selective and very conscious and very responsible about who you allow to source you with fresh thoughts, fresh energy, fresh information. And that would be based on, you know, what do you read? What are you listening to? Who, most importantly, who are you hanging around?
Right.
You know, one of the great things about the people business, if you're in the positive people business, is, you know, you can spend a lot of time with people who are on the same quest as you. And normally those people don't get together. Salespeople, network marketers, business people don't get together and tell each other, you know, how doomed they are. If they do, that you need a different group to be around. It's simple.
Yeah, if they do, you got to get away from them right away.
So manage the source of input.
Well, you know, let's kind of get into some of the things that they can do. If the listeners on this call, some of the things they can do right now to change direction, you know, start on a little bit better path to success in their life. And how can they stay focused, committed to their decision? And right here, I know you want to talk about the beliefs and everything and just how to get it in. You know, what are some simple things that they can do right now to just get started on the right track if they want to? Which I'm sure they do, or they wouldn't be on this call. I mean, this is really profound, Richard. You do know that, don't you?
Well, I don't hold it as all that profound because, you know, this information has been shared by much more powerful, wiser, influential people than me for hundreds of years, if not thousands.
But here's the thing. Sometimes people have been fed this information over and over, but sometimes you hear it a different way or you read it a different way, and all of a sudden it's like someone slapped you alongside the head and you're thinking, why haven't I thought about that before? And it's probably something that you've heard, and it's so insanely simple, but people don't get it. So anything that you say...
You're right, Karen. And the reason I wrote this book is the way I learned this information from a variety of different sources, none of them as a sole source of it did it for me. Some of them confused me. Some of them depressed me. Some of them didn't fill in the whole picture. I have an engineer's kind of mind. I like to know why things work, not just that they do work. I want to know why the secret works, and I want to know how I can make the secret work in my life and how it actually works psychologically. I don't respond to, isn't it wonderful that it works? That doesn't do it for me. I need to know why. But to answer your question, what can people do? I think the most important thing people can do, if they have the book, and I'm not a book salesman, it doesn't matter to me if you buy the book. In fact, you can download it for free, I think, off my site if you just want the paper stuff on it. There is a set of exercises in the book that lead you to discover a distinction between your imposed values and your core values. And values are very simply this. It's not a complicated woo-woo thing. It's just very simply this. What are the most important things to you in life? Like, well, here's what's important to me. Health is important to me. Relationships are important to me. Friends are important to me. Fun is important to me. Leadership is important to me. Adventure is important to me. And success is important to me. Integrity is important to me. Honesty is important to me. Those things are very important to me. If I don't have those things in my life, I am either dead or insane. Mm-hmm. I must have those in my life. Now, there's some things that I also think I must have in my life because my parents told me I must have them in my life. And they told me during a period of years where when we get input from prenatal through age 5, we don't discern, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I think I'm going to like fun. When we get values imposed upon us during those years, we don't discern whether it's a good value or not. We just accept it. It's part of our DNA, and we don't question it. And one of the most powerful things that people can do is have a conversation about what's really important to you if your parents gave you permission for it to be important to you, or if society gave you permission for it to be important to you. If your family gave you permission, if there weren't consequences, what would be important to you? And go through the process of separating surgically in your mind your imposed values from your core values. Now, sometimes they're the same.
Right.
My dad had a very important value of fun, and he never told me I should have fun. He just lived fun. And I got that from him. But it's also a core value. It's spiritual for me. I must be having fun. And so when you get in touch with your core values, here's what happens. You start to unlock your spiritual power. You start to unlock your authentic power. I believe one of the greatest governors on our success, our power, our accomplishments, how much fun we're having, the contribution we are to the world, is when we access our own authenticity, when we play the game the way we want to play it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'll spend some time thinking about that and then writing down some things you want in your life, whether it's cars, trains, boats, homes, a better relationship, better health, a different place to live, you know, no debt, whatever. If you start writing those things down, you have taken a step that 97% of the people in this country never take. You put yourself on a path to be a 3%er just by going through that exercise. And I know a lot of people, it's happened for a lot of people on this call. You write those things down, especially if you write them down in the form of a vision. You may do like a lot of people do. I mean, there's been hundreds of thousands of people that have bought this book and read it, and thousands of people that have been through my workshops, and they go through the exercise, and they put all the stuff in a drawer or in their binder or in their briefcase, and I get letters and emails, you know, every year, half a dozen or a dozen of them, people tell me, you know, I found something I put away after one of your workshops. I found it 5, 6, 7 years later, and almost everything on the list was done.
Mm-hmm.
You put yourself in the 3%er position just by doing that one exercise and committing those things that you want your life to be like in writing. And if you want to take yourself from a 3%er to a 0.3%er, put it in the form of a vision and read it every day. And that's probably the one step, Karen, that people aren't willing to do.
Right.
It's, you know, it's like...
It takes time. It takes commitment. And it's the one thing anybody, like you said, any of the top 3%ers, they've done that. They know where they're going. They've written down. They have a clear plan of action, exactly how their life is programmed, exactly what's going to be happening.
Yeah, and here's the distinction that I really want to presence, because this is what got me most excited about this work. When I learned the difference between a goal and a vision, I got very, very excited, and it's one of the things that inspired this book.
Mm-hmm.
The psychological pathway for generating motivation comes from a vision. It does not come from a goal. A goal gets us a long ways down the path, because when we write a goal down, we do start to imagine it already done. When we visualize a goal, you know, I want a new car, I want whatever. When we think about it, we think about it already being done. But the limiting factor of a goal is the way we write it, the affirming of it, is not that we have a new car, or we have a great relationship, or we have wealth. The way we've been taught traditionally to write goals is not that we have these things, that we want these things.
Right.
And what you create by writing goals in that traditional fashion is really nothing more than a vision of wanting things. It doesn't draw the motivation out the way writing your goals that you already have them does. Because writing them that you already have them, that creates a vision that contrasts with reality. And when you create a vision that contrasts with reality, when there's a gap between what is happening now and what you expect to be happening, what you demand of yourself to be happening, what you believe is inevitable, you will create the motivation to get the job done. And I don't know if you're going to ask about it, Karen, but I do want to speak to what motivation looks like, smells like, tastes like, and is, so people have that distinction.
Yep, go ahead and talk about it.
Go there. Okay, so the first component of motivation is enthusiasm. And, you know, I did sort of make some of this stuff up, but not really, because it all makes sense and it fits. When you and I are enthusiastic, when we're motivated, we are enthusiastic. And when we are enthusiastic about a particular goal or endeavor, what do we do about it? And what do we attract about it? So, you know, maybe you have a goal to, you know, build a business of some sort. If you're on fire about that goal, are people attracted to you?
Absolutely.
Of course they are. People want to be around people that are on fire. If you're depressed and angry and worried about your goal, nobody wants to be within 100 miles of you. In addition, if you're on fire about your goal, you will act in a way to bring it about. You'll do the daily things that need to be done. And I like to ask it this way to people. Take any goal that you have. If you could get yourself and keep yourself, like every day, get yourself and keep yourself enthusiastic enough about the outcome and about the process, what could you accomplish? And I think if people think about that for just a second or a minute, there's just only one answer to it, and that is anything. Mm-hmm. Enthusiasm alone will get the job done based on who you attract and what actions you're naturally empowered to take when you're enthusiastic. So another component of motivation is physical energy. If you could get yourself and keep yourself every day energized enough, like take any time in your life when you've been physically completely on fire about getting stuff done. Like, you don't sleep in till 8 o'clock. You jump out of bed. You can't wait to get to the computer, the telephone, the office, the prospects, the whatever it is. You
the
can't
gym.
Wait to get there. Whatever it is, you have the physical energy to get the job done. Now, physical energy alone won't get a lot of goals done, but I think everybody on this call realizes how many times they've dropped the ball on projects because they were tired. Tired is not a function of physicality. Tired is a function of motivation. Take you to any time you fell in love in your life. Think about sometime you fell in love. How many people on this call have slept 4 or 5 hours a night, if that, driven hundreds of miles back and forth, done just seemingly impossible things to manifest the vision of being with somebody that you were in love with? And, you know, it happens in sports. It happens in business. When you and I are on fire, we have the physical energy that we need. Courage is another huge component of motivation. It's a huge component of getting things done. Anybody on this call, you just think about tomorrow. Think about the things you could do tomorrow to move yourself closer to manifesting what it is you want, whether it's, you know, public speaking or talking to prospects or whatever. There's almost always a huge component of courage, and courage is nothing more than seeing an opportunity, seeing something you know you need to do, knowing that there's some danger there. If there's no danger, there's no need for courage. So you see something. Maybe it's a prospect. You think about a prospect, and you think, well, you know, if I talk to them, they'll reject me or whatever. You see some possible negative outcome. But people who are highly motivated, what do they do with possible dangerous opportunities, opportunities they know they need to act on? They do it anyway. They just get up in front of the room anyway. They get on the phone anyway. They just blow right through it. So ask yourself, what could you get done in manifesting what you want in your life if you could get yourself and keep yourself every day courageous enough? Nothing that came up that gave you a tinge of fear stopped you, not even for a second. You just blew right through it. What could you accomplish? Anything.
Absolutely.
And the last and most important component of motivation, this one makes all the rest of them pale, is creativity. We have it in this society that creativity is a genetic thing, or it's an intellect thing, or something that we got from going to school or something. It doesn't have anything to do with any of those things. People that are massively creative are just massively motivated. And if you go back and look at any time in your life when you were powerfully motivated, whether it was accidental or on purpose, you will find that you were infinitely creative. You came up with incredible ideas mm-hmm. to get the job done or solve problems that stood in your way. And that's only half of creativity. The other half of creativity is what we call creative interpretations. So most people think that it's a positive mental attitude. You got to have a positive mental attitude, and that leads to success. What they're missing is, how do you get a positive mental attitude? Do you get it from just reading books and tapes? No, you don't. You don't get it from just reading books and tapes. People who are highly motivated have positive, creative interpretations about circumstances and scenarios. So, for example, in our business, in the network marketing business, I mean, the holy grail is if you could prospect 5 people a day with enthusiasm and courage, and you did that for a couple of years, I think everybody on this call knows you'd be wealthy forever. So how do you do that? Well, when you see an opportunity, whether it's to get up in front of the room and speak or talk to a prospect, or maybe you need to have tough love coaching call with somebody, or people see opportunities when they're motivated, powerfully motivated. They make up before they act that the outcome is going to be good. Karen, thank you for this opportunity. I have followed you for years. You're an enormous contribution in the direct selling industry. And
well, one of the things that I think that we share in common, Richard, is that we both tell it like it is. It is not easy. Life is a roller coaster. You're going to have ups and you're going to have downs. The only thing that's going to make a difference is whether you're going to go up that hill one more time, because it's, you know, I love what Irma Bombeck says, just live life to the fullest and, you know, slide in and say, wow, what a ride. But I know it's after 10, but if you can just give them like 1 or 2 minutes, words of wisdom, something to just sum it up, to just give them, you know, just send them out here on fire so that they can get out, you know, get out there and do it. And really just a couple of minutes here and just share something with them.
Well, two things come to mind, Karen. One is, and I guess if I tell you about this, I'm not affirming it, but maybe by telling you about it, you can leapfrog your way through it so you don't get trapped by it. One of the ironies of people embracing this technology and these habits is it requires that you do some action steps that are uncomfortable and are not perhaps part of your daily routine. And the irony of that is that it takes motivation to even learn how to be motivated. And I think that's actually what stops most people and has most people miss this opportunity. Is intellectually they understand it, makes sense, it's wonderful, great, nice, da-da-da-da. But they don't realize that they actually need some motivation to take action to do something new in their life about it. So if you'll realize that and just pay attention to what you do with this call and what you do with this information, and maybe make a note to check yourself in a week. In a week. See if a week's gone by, have you done anything about it? If you haven't done anything about it, it's not because you don't want to do anything about it. It's not because you don't want to be motivated and you don't want to have all these great things in your life, is it? You want all that stuff. You want to be a master of vision and motivation. You even want to be teaching it, perhaps. But a week's gone by and you haven't done anything about it. Why is that? Because desire doesn't have anything to do with it. Desire just points you in a direction and you're still on first base. To do something about it, you have to be motivated. You have to have a vision of doing something about it. You have to see yourself doing something about it. And the catch-22 is that if you haven't done anything, it's because you have a vision of not doing anything. So maybe use that to sort of thump your bowl and do something about this. The magical part of this process is, folks, that it doesn't take very much of this. Just a tiny bit of this work goes a million miles. I'm telling you, there's people on this call, if we open up the lines, I'm telling you, people would raise their hands and tell us hair-raising stories of how they did this work in one workshop in one day somewhere by some instructor, some form of it, put it away in a drawer, put it in a book, forgot all about it, accidentally found it 5 years later. And their skin's crawling because almost everything on the list is done. What if you would have actually committed it to a habit, to a lifestyle, to something that you did every day? What if you actually perfected the art of writing a vision instead of just writing a few things down on a list and putting it away? What if you actually embraced everything about how to make that story real in your mind and your heart, and you read it twice a day? You actually closed your eyes and took a couple minutes and read it and visualized it and let your whole body, every cell in your body, just drink it all in and have it become part of your DNA. What would happen is you would get more done in the next 12 months than you probably have in the last 12 years. And just by getting on that path, then your results start to feed your vision. You know, all of a sudden, if your income is increasing 20, 30, 40% a month, That's like nitro. That's like gasoline on the fire. Now you don't need to spend so much time reading and visualizing. You're actually looking at results.
Right.
And those results fuel you. You really only need this technology to kickstart you when you want to produce quantum leap results. Because once you get kickstarted, the results themselves will be the wind beneath your wings. I would just challenge people, just suck it up, cowboy up, cowgirl up, grab the book, grab the exercises, take 3 or 4 weeks. You know, it's kind of like tackling the gym. You can do anything for 3 or 4 weeks. Give it a whirl, and it'll blow your mind, blow your heart, blow your spirit what you can accomplish in the next 12 months.
Absolutely amazing. So basically, everyone on this call, here's my last thing to you. You can either make excuses as to why you are the way you are, or you're going to find a way to change. And Richard's book right now can start leading you on the path to making that change. Richard, thank you so much for joining me. I love this call. I want to thank you for joining me. Thank everyone that joined us on this call that was listening in. And just remind everybody, I know we had a lot of Canadians. We have people from all around the world on this call, which is really exciting. Those of you in the U.S., 2 days from now, we have Thanksgiving. Take time to really be thankful for everything that you have in your life. Gratitude goes a long way. When you take time to have some gratitude and thankfulness in your life, you will find more and more things to be thankful for along your journey of your life. And again, thank you for joining me, Richard. I really, really appreciated it.
You're welcome, Karen. Thank you.
Have
good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. Have a good night.